Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 292, and we're going to talk about eating without cooking. Pretend I added reverb to that part there. Yes, folks, you can have meals without doing any cooking. And I don't mean fast food. We're also going to talk about the advantages of analog versus digital multimeters, a product review of something in your pocket that can help you sleep, and a tale from the road involving some folks who had different ideas on travel than I do. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am about to enter one of the busiest months of my life, and I'm going to be all over the place. I'm getting back onto the Royal Clipper in Lisbon, Portugal, and I'm going to take it all the way around Gibraltar and up into the Mediterranean and eventually end up in Villefranche-sur-Mer, which is kind of between Nice and Monaco and Ez, or however you pronounce that town. It's going to be busy, and that means I'm going to be pre-recording some podcast stuff going forward. So I'm going to try not to miss a week. We'll see if I can actually pull that off. I'm going to try. But that also means that stuff that's going to come after this podcast, except maybe next week, is, you know, could be dated. Like if something happens and some company releases a brand new affordable van that's easy to build out, I might not get to that for a bit. And boy, I hope that happens. Wouldn't that be nice? That would be really nice. Like just a nice, say, $30,000 van that was kind of square and simple and reluctant. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I'm dreaming. Don't forget the date, folks. This episode's coming out April Fool's Day. Okay, that said, I had an interesting conversation with my AI this morning, which I know annoys most of you, but what can I say? I live an AI life these days, and our conversation revolved around the concept of chicken eggs. I don't mean the concept as in which came first, the chicken or the egg, because it was clearly the egg. We know this now. No, it was about why Americans are so weird about eggs, and we are. If you live in the U.S. and you want to go buy a dozen eggs, and for some reason that's how they're sold in a dozen, you will go to the refrigerated section. And it's usually at the back of the store because it's typically a low-profit item and they want you to pass all the high-profit stuff as you get back there. But why is it in the refrigerator? It's because Americans do things to their eggs that other countries don't do. And if you've never been to a supermarket in Europe, you should go, number one. But number two, you'll find that their eggs are just on the shelf, like next to the cereal. They're not refrigerated. Are their chickens different? No, their chickens are making the same eggs our chickens are. They're basically the same chickens. The difference is that in the U.S., we wash eggs. There's a cuticle on eggs that is an airtight membrane. And when we wash the eggs to get all the kind of stuff that can get on eggs off, we also wash off the cuticle, and that removes that membrane, which is a safety thing. So once that membrane is removed, you have a nice clean egg that all Americans are used to, but you have to refrigerate it because there's no barrier anymore and stuff can actually penetrate the eggshell and give disease to you, which you don't want. In Europe, they don't do that. They lightly clean the eggs, but don't remove the cuticle, which gives them a shelf life of 5 or 6 weeks unrefrigerated. But here's the interesting thing I learned today. The best practice for the freshest, safest eggs is to do both. That is, don't wash the eggs, but also refrigerate them, which kind of makes sense. But so far as I know, nobody does that. There's no country I can find. That's not true. I have never seen that. I do believe there are some places where you can do this, but they have unwashed eggs in the refrigerator. Those are the safest eggs. Anyway, that's actually just a non sequitur here, but that's how I got to the topic for today's podcast, along with some other stuff. That gave me the idea that if you are traveling on the road and you do not have cooling and you want eggs, what you should actually do is find a farm that's selling eggs. Buy unwashed eggs, which you can do in all the middle of the U.S. and I'm sure any place where there are farms, you'll see little signs that say eggs for sale, $4 a dozen or whatever. Or there's even little boxes at the end of the driveway where you can put money in and just take eggs. Those eggs don't need to be refrigerated as much as the eggs from the supermarket. So if you were having issues with refrigeration in your vehicle, or you simply don't have any, and you wanted to have eggs that were safer than ones you could buy at the store in the U.S., which, by the way, have a 5-hour shelf life outside the refrigerator. That's right. You're not supposed to leave eggs out more than 5 hours. I have certainly done that many, many times, but you're not supposed to. Yeah, you can get them from farms. And then I thought back to Nelly's video that came out last week. So Nelly, who I brought up many times lately because she is one of those people that has an influencing personality. She's working to become an influencer, so that makes sense. Nelly has great ideas, and she recently released a video called Nelly's No Cook Video. That's what I called it. Actually, I don't know what she called it, but it's a video about how she lives in her Ford Transit Connect and does as little cooking as possible, but still eats well. And I don't mean by going to fast food all the time. No, she is bringing food with her in a cooler, and watch the video. The video is linked in the show notes. You can find it on her YouTube page and other places. Her handle is Nelly in a Can. Definitely check that out and subscribe because she's got good stuff. But I thought, okay, let's up the challenge here. What if we came up with a list of ways to eat well in your van that require no cooking, no refrigeration, and very minimal cleanup, almost no cleanup? Like, wiping off a knife, I'm not going to count as cleanup. And throwing away a paper towel, that doesn't count. I'm talking about no doing dishes. And, well, here's what I came up with. Now, I did not pay any attention to cost here. So I just threw cost out. We're going to put cost away. We're just going to come up with a list of foods that you can cook in your van, that you can prepare in your van that don't require anything. I mean, this would work in anywhere at any time. All this stuff needs to be is with you and you can do it. And some of the stuff is crazy, but that's okay because the idea here is to generate ideas in you. So for those days when you're driving and you don't have any time or you want to grab a bite just for 5 minutes at a rest stop or whatever, maybe some of this stuff will appeal to you and give you some ideas, okay? All right, the first thought I had was don't buy complete meals, buy components of meals. Now, there are, you know, there are TV dinners, quote unquote, that don't require refrigeration, like Hormel Completes are the most common ones. Yeah, you can certainly buy those. And if you leave them in the dashboard on a hot summer day for a couple hours, they're like they came out of the microwave. So there's one thing you can do. But I thought, let's be a little bit more fancy than that. Those Hormel Completes are fine, but I don't know anyone who thinks that they're actually, you know, good. They're just food. And then, of course, there are MREs, which are meals ready to eat that the military uses. They're super fancy these days, folks. If you haven't seen what they do now, you add a little bit of water and then they heat themselves. And the quality of the meals is surprisingly good. The problem with MREs, well, there's two problems. One is that they're expensive, but the other problem is that they are super calorie dense. I mean, one of those things can be as much as 3,000 calories because they're made for soldiers who are doing arduous tasks in uncomfortable conditions. They're not made for the person, saying, driving 10 hours in a van. So MREs are an option. Having a couple of MREs in your rig as kind of like an emergency thing is not a terrible idea, although they have a shelf life. So the idea of modular eating is you want to fulfill your needs for the day, right? So everybody's got different dietary choices and needs, and I'm just going to be general here. You know what's right for you, so just ignore the stuff that doesn't apply to you. But you want to start with a base of some sort of carbs, typically. So tortillas, crackers, rice cakes, something like that. All of those things don't need refrigeration. They're easy to store. They don't take up very much space. And as long as they're in a container that is tight, you know, keep rodents and insects out, they'll last for weeks in your van. So that's easy. Then you want a protein and a fat or a combination thereof. So one choice could be peanut butter. That's a really obvious one. Peanut butter and tortillas, peanut butter and crackers, peanut butter and rice cakes, that's almost a meal right there. However, there's also tuna. Now, Nelly mentions this in her video, but there's tuna in the cans, which is fine, but you have to drain those, and then the tuna's super wet, and the pouches actually work better. Now, I think they're a little bit more expensive, but the pouches come in a lot more flavors. They are literally, you open the pouch and you're ready to go. You don't have to do anything to them. And if you want to add a little mayo or whatever, sure, you can grab a packet the next time you're at the gas station. but that is also a complete meal. And another thing you can do, and again, be creative here, is you can get those cheese sticks that are not refrigerated and meat sticks that are not refrigerated and just wrap them up in a tortilla. That is a meal. That is all you need, and there's no cleanup and no cooking, and it will keep in your van. And to augment this, you also probably would like to have something fresh, so fruits or vegetables. Now, a lot of these require refrigeration or aren't very durable. I mean, bananas are great. I love bananas, but if I'm in my van, I will only buy enough bananas for 2 or 3 days, because after that, I know that even if they haven't gone bad, they're going to get banged up. Even in a net or whatever, just the motion of the road is going to bruise the bananas. So I typically will buy bananas for short periods only, or like literally I will buy a banana and then eat it immediately, which is, you know, an option you have. Instead of going to the rest area, go to the supermarket in town and buy all your stuff fresh right there and just eat it as you go. You can use the restroom in there. And if you're lucky, it's one that has a gas station. Like Hy-Vee's in Illinois have gas stations at the supermarket. Very convenient. Now, citrus fruits are good. Citrus fruits will last a long time without refrigeration. Cuties, I always have a bag of cuties in my van. They're easy, simple, small. They do make your fingernails dirty, though. So if you've ever noticed that you've been driving all day and your fingernails look like you've been digging in the dirt, yeah, that's the citrus that does that. It's the oils get under your skin and oxidize and turn brown. So weird little thing I noticed. Apples, of course, are good. You have to protect them a little bit more than citrus. Citrus can take a beating. Apples, you know, hang them in the bag or put them in your shoes. This is a trick. If you're not grossed out by that, you can actually put apples in your shoes and that'll keep them from getting dented and stuff. And then don't forget vegetables. You know, romaine lettuce, if you leave it in the bag, this is what I do with romaine lettuce. And I have not verified this other than my own personal experience, but I will buy 3 heads of romaine lettuce in a bag. That's typically how they come. I will open the bag and wash them all and put them back in the bag wet. I know you're thinking, oh, the water's going to get in there and get all gross. But in my experience, that isn't what happens, because that romaine lettuce head is actually alive. You can literally take that head of lettuce and plant it in the ground, and it will keep growing. It is a living food, which is good because that means it won't go bad quickly. And that rinsing and leaving the water on there actually nourishes the lettuce a bit and helps it last longer. That's my experience. I have not backed that up with any science. But that gives you all kinds of options. So you can add lettuce to just about everything. And romaine is a fairly nutritious lettuce. Lettuce is not really high on the nutrition standards anywhere. But as far as lettuces go, romaine is a good one. And it makes these nice little boats. Like you can take a leaf and cut the end off and you can fill that with tuna or peanut butter or chickpeas that you got out of a can or a pouch, or maybe one of those rice packets that is ready to go. You just open the packet and there's your rice. You could put some of that in there. And you've got hot sauces that don't need to be refrigerated. The idea here is not to think in terms of a meal when you shop, but to think in terms of ingredients that you can use to make a meal. And all these things I've mentioned don't require refrigeration or cleanup. Don't forget the power of nuts and jerky. Jerky is high in sodium, it's true. Some of them are high in sugar as well. But it is tough, it is full of protein, it is somewhat satisfying, and it will last forever. Nuts, the same thing. I love peanuts. You give me a bag of unsalted peanuts in the shell, and I will eat way too many and make myself sick. This is a problem I have. I'm working on myself. But for right now, I am a danger around peanuts. Peanuts are a great source of protein and calories, and they will last forever. You do have to be a little bit careful about rodents with nuts, because they love nuts. Pistachios, the same thing, kind of high in sodium usually, unless you can find unsalted ones. Macadamia nuts, any nuts can be added to meals in creative ways. And the other thing I've learned doing this, by having this component way of thinking about food, although I do have refrigeration and cooking in my rig, to be clear, I have just decided to throw weird things in to see what happens. Like, I will take pistachios and toss them into soup. I like it. It gives a little bit of weird texture. Same thing with kernel corn. Frozen kernel corn is my go-to. It doesn't work for this example, but I will toss that into all kinds of things. And to me, it just adds a little bit of interesting texture and sweetness. You could do the same thing with canned corn. Also, don't forget grapes. Grapes are great, a little bit fragile. They don't last all that long if they're not refrigerated. I don't need to give you a complete list. I'm just giving you the idea here. So here are some other things, and I'm going to go down each category and just run down a list. Okay, so for protein and fat, you've got tuna and salmon packets. If you like them, you've got sardines and mackerel tins, beef jerky, biltong, which some would call beef jerky, but it's more of an African thing, meat sticks like Slim Jims, you know, nut butter packets. There is not only peanut butter, you can also get almond butter packets, and you can keep almond butter in your van as well too. It will may separate, but that is okay. If you ever have peanut butter where it forms oil on the top, that's fine. That's normal. It's actually not normal to have peanut butter that doesn't have oil on the top. That is something that manufacturing does. So if you have oil on the top, just mix it in. It's fine. Chickpeas and fava beans, you can actually eat as they are. You don't have to cook them. Anything canned is already cooked. So if it comes in a can, you don't have to cook it. The only reason you're cooking it is to make it hot, basically. So if you like chickpeas, you can get a can, drain them, and put them in whatever you want. Same with fava beans. Good source of nutrition and protein. There are, of course, protein shakes. You know, if you're really worried about starvation, you can throw a six-pack of Ensure in your rig, and one of those will keep you alive for a couple days. And this is not something I've ever seen, but I'm told it exists. There is such a thing as shelf-stable tofu. It's called aseptic tofu, which is about the most unappealing thing I've ever heard of food called, but that's what it's called. And if you're a tofu person, which if you're not a tofu person, you should actually reconsider that, because tofu is like the magic food that to become anything you want. That's an option too. No refrigeration needed for that tofu. Now for the carbs, we've already mentioned tortillas and crackers and rice cakes, but there's also pita bread. Pita bread's great. You can do all kinds of things with pita bread. You can put a salad in there. You can put meats in there. I mean, it's just a little pocket of bread. You can do whatever you want. Naan, you can buy pre-made naan that gives a little bit more flavor. If you're not familiar with naan, that's the kind of bread they have in Indian restaurants. And there are flatbreads, which some would argue, well, that's just a big cracker, isn't it? I mean, you understand. Pretzels are always a great thing. They will last forever. And then there's, you know, dry cereal. You don't have to get Fruit Loops. You can if you want to get Fruit Loops and cut up the roof of your mouth like crazy, but granola, yes, it's a breakfast cereal, but it was also something just to eat, like out of the bag. A few handfuls of granola, actually that's too much, maybe even a single handful of granola, and you're full. That's like a meal. So for fruit, we mentioned apples, bananas, oranges, grapes. Peaches are another good one, but they have a short window. Peaches are on my list of things I would buy if I were going to eat them that day. Pears, similar to apples, except that they're more fragile. And they have a ripeness issue, you know. You don't really find an unripe apple at the store, but pears, they, you know, they're like avocados. They've got that sweet spot that's a little ephemeral. Plums, any of the stone fruits, nectarines, you know, all that type of thing are in the same category there. Now, for vegetables, which people don't think of this way necessarily, but think of crudité. So you're going to have crudité. So you can have carrots, snap peas, those mini bell peppers, those are great. My wife doesn't like them so much, she thinks they're too sweet, but I love them. And I'll get a bag of those mini bell peppers. They'll last a good week anyway without refrigeration. And then I cut them into strips and I just dip them into whatever I have salad dressing-wise, any salad dressing really. And that is a nice, fairly healthy snack. And it's much easier than having like a bell pepper, a big bell pepper that when you cut it, then you've got like half a bell pepper and boy, you should really refrigerate that and it just doesn't last as long. Cherry tomatoes, obviously. Celery sticks, obviously. Although celery doesn't do all that well without refrigeration. If you do the celery stick thing, you might want to consider cutting the celery sticks and putting them in water and then changing the water every day. But I don't know about that. I'm not a big celery guy, so do your own research there. Radishes. Now, this is a great one. Radishes will last a really long time outside the refrigerator. In fact, you'll notice in most stores, radishes are not in the refrigerated section. They're just misted every day. You could actually set yourself up some way to mist vegetables with a hand mister. But even without that, radishes are going to last a good long time. And the thing about radishes is they have so much flavor that they can improve almost anything so long as you like the taste of radishes. And you can actually put them in soups and things, too. There's nothing stopping you from putting any combination of things together. Yeah, okay, Gordon Ramsay might yell at you, but who cares? He's not in your van, and he's also not invited. Pouch foods, if you want to be a little less inventive, there are lots of Indian pouch foods now. Dal, lentils, chickpeas, curries in pouches that you can eat right out of the pouch. You might prefer them to be warm. If that's the case, well, I've got a couple ideas for you. You can put them in the dashboard and let them heat up in the sun. But you know what, guys? This actually works. You can put them in your shirt. This in the winter, even. You're all bundled up. Take the packet of Dal or whatever, put it in your shirt and leave it there for an hour. And when you take it out, it'll be near your body temperature. And actually, that is warm enough to make it much more enjoyable. And if you've got a dog, never mind, I'm getting a little crazy here. The pouch, take a look at the pouch things. They are not the least expensive, but there's a whole bunch of not only Indian meals, but other things too. There's beans, there's rice that has stuff in it. There's olive oil pouches. If you don't want to have a whole packet of olive oil, if you look, you can find olive oil pouches, which is a whole bottle of olive oil. You can find olive oil pouches. And there's even pickles that come like that too, prepackaged pickles. Although pickles is another great one. You can get a jar of pickles and just leave it unrefrigerated and it's fine so long as you didn't get it from the refrigerated section. You want to get something like Vlasic or something that's on the aisle, not in the refrigerated section. Now, if you want calorie-dense stuff that you can just munch and just get over a little bit of time where you're hungry, obviously trail mix. You can make your own trail mix. Don't forget dried fruits, mangoes, apricots, raisins. Your dentist might tell you that it's not a great idea for your teeth, but, you know, brush your teeth afterwards or at least chew some gum. Dark chocolate is a great idea. You have to worry about it melting, but it doesn't melt the way milk chocolate does. So if you have dark chocolate and you store it somewhere in your van that's out of the sun and, you know, embedded somewhere where it doesn't get a lot of heat, that can be a great thing. And it can also be a big pick-me-up when you've just been eating stuff you don't really like. Also, you've got the energy and protein bars, but you know that. Honey packets aren't a bad thing to have, just to flavor things. They're pretty easy to find if you go anywhere that sells biscuits. And that's one of the things I would suggest is get a bunch of condiments. It's funny, I was with Liz this weekend at the City Museum with Jen, and I showed her the City Museum, which is a great place. You absolutely should go visit. It's in St. Louis. And she is living in her van right now, heading back to Canada. And every time we went somewhere where they had little packets, she'd wait to see, and then, like, you know, oop, there goes some ketchup, and oop, there's the mustard. And she was very kind about it. She wasn't abusing anything. We were buying things from these people. But I was like, oh yeah, I know exactly what you're doing. But I think everybody should do that. Those little packets can come in very handy to make a bland meal suddenly taste like something you're happy to be eating. So bottom line here is, don't think so much about planning meals, unless you enjoy doing that. I'm not trying to tell anyone what to do. But think about having components such that when you want a meal, you've got things, you've got options. You can make what you want. And everything we've talked about here should be doable without refrigeration, without cooking, and without a lot of cleanup. You don't need to go crazy. On the cleanup thing, I'll say a couple of things. At Boy Scout camp in the 80s, we had to make salad for 30 people. And we didn't have, you know, giant bowls. We were literally living in the woods cooking for ourselves. There was no dining hall. We had to go get firewood. We cooked on a shepherd stove. This was like, you know, real camping. So how do you make salad for 30 people? Well, one of the guys was an ex-army guy, and he offered to cook for us that night, and I was just paying attention and watching. And he found a milk crate, which we did have milk crates, and he put a trash bag in the milk crate and just made the salad in the trash bag. Obviously, it was a brand new trash bag. And yes, trash bags are not food safe, etc. We didn't have a lot of knowledge about the safety of plastics back in the 80s. But it doesn't matter, because whatever you're putting in there isn't going to sit in there. If you want to avoid cleanup, you can put a plastic bag over a bowl or in a cardboard box and mix things up in there and then just throw that bag out or use it for the trash for the day. You know, you can do that too. So just throwing that idea out there. That's a thing to help save with cleanup. Yeah, plastic, food safe plastic, there's all kinds of issues there. But for short term stuff, like mixing a salad, don't put the dressing in there if you're worried about the acid of the dressing doing something with the plastic. I think it's fine. I can tell you, I did that in the 80s, and I'm still here, and it hasn't affected me much. Well, all right, maybe I should say that. Thanks to everyone who has visited buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's two T's, not three, not one. and bought me some gallons. I appreciate it. It keeps ads off of this podcast, and I especially appreciate those of you who donate every month. You are my favorites. You always will be, because that's how that goes. If you would like to help support the podcast and keep ads far, far away, visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go and buy me a gallon or two or whatever of any liquid you choose. Go ahead and tell me in the comments which liquid you are buying me. Since I no longer have much use for diesel, I had to just kind of do it like this. And if you enjoy the podcast just the way it is, and you do not have the inclination or funds to donate, that's fine. You are also always welcome. Van Life News. Terry sent me a nice link, which is interesting. Terry sent me this link about Costco and their standalone gas station. So Costco, if you are unaware, Costco is a big box store. It's a membership store, so it's a little bit different, but very, very popular. They're in the news all the time. And it's the kind of place where you go and you want to buy an onion, but they only sell them by the dozen, or actually more like two dozen at Costco. They also have gas stations in most Costco locations, and their gas is usually 5 to 10 cents cheaper than any other gas anywhere around, because of the way they handle their gas. Now, they don't tell you what brand gas it is. They say it's top tier. You can Google and see what all the sleuths have figured out, but it's decent gasoline. And in Chicago, I live two blocks from a Costco, as it happens, and the gas station always has a line of 15 or 30 cars at it, because gas here is about $5 a gallon as of this week. So things are, you know, a bit rough here, like they are everywhere, and California is looking at me laughing. And as is the rest of the world. But Costco has just announced that they're going to have standalone gas stations. And the first ones are going to be in California, and it's an experiment. But it's really interesting because Costco is a membership model. You have to pay to shop there. I think it's $40 a year, which, by the way, is their highest revenue item. They make most of their profit off of the memberships, not what they sell, which means they don't mark up the products very much, which is kind of the conceit. You pay a membership so you don't have to pay as much on the stuff. The more you buy, the more you save, etc. I don't know about all that. I don't know that their prices are all that great, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about this concept that they're basically creating membership-only gas stations. And that won't work all that well for van lifers or nomads unless it spreads nationwide. But if you happen to live near one of these places, you might be able to do the math and see, yeah, that might work. Oh, who knows? We're living in a time where gas prices are suddenly a very, very big deal. And this is a step towards something. So anyway, you can read the article. It was from Jalopnik. And thank you to Terry for sending that to me. I have been seeing a lot of talk about safety on the road. People are very afraid these days. Things happen, they see them on the news, and they think, oh, that could happen to me. What can I do to protect myself? Completely normal and natural. And I was just involved in a thread on Facebook about RV owners and how they keep themselves safe. And, well, I got my 9mm by the bed, and I got my 12-gauge in the closet, and I put two locks on the door, and they have all these things to turn their RVs into a fortress. And I'm like, well, okay, I mean, as long as you're following the laws, you know, you get to do what you want. But I decided to actually look into the stats on crime, because I have heard for a while that crime is really, really going down. And every politician in the world is always going to try to take credit for that, right? Like, since I took office, crime has gone down. Yeah, okay. Since the 1990s, crime has gone down almost every year. There have been some upticks. COVID was a weird time and things were weird there. But basically, since 1990, whatever the heck it is, crime has gone down. And right now, violent crime and homicides are at the lowest point in human history. That is not hyperbole. That is backed up with stats. And I have an article that you can read here. It's from the Council on Criminal Justice. So that's councilonCJ.org. And the name of the article is State of the Union, Why is Crime Going Down? And anyway, it's a link. You don't have to remember all that. But they're taking a broad approach and such. But yeah, nothing will belie the fact that overall, certainly some places are worse than others, crime is very, very low. But at the same time, fear is very, very high. And this is an incongruency. I find it odd and fascinating. You are safer now, out in public, than you ever have been in human history. Statistically. Not based on your personal situation. You have to understand those things. So why are people so afraid? I don't know. And it's beyond the scope of this podcast, but I find it fascinating. I did have a more extended conversation with a 77-year-old woman who saw about someone getting attacked on a bus, and then somebody broke in, and she says, see what happens out there? I have to protect myself. And I was like, well, yeah, I do see what happens out there, but I also see that, you know, quote unquote, if it bleeds, it leads. If you just watch the news, you are getting skewed data. It is skimmed and filtered and does not show the big picture, which is that crime is actually pretty low and it keeps getting lower. And I'm going to throw this in here. Some people might think this is political, but it's actually just statistics. Undocumented immigrants commit fewer crimes than the population as a whole. That's just a fact. The crimes they do commit get all kinds of attention for political purposes. But in reality, if you had 100 people in a community and 50 undocumented people moved into that community, you would have less crime per capita based on the general stats. Take that for what it's worth. It's just statistics. But I mention that only to say that there is this great fear that probably isn't based in anything. I have a link here for you to go down this rabbit hole about the leaded gas theory. And there is a correlation between the amount of lead in gasoline, which then means the amount of lead in the environment, and violence in society. And it is a very, very strong correlation. However, correlation does not mean causation. There's lots of correlations out there. The invention of the electric motor is correlated with the decline of high seas pirates a la Captain Kidd. Okay? That's a correlation. There's probably not much of a relationship there, but there is a correlation. Causation, no. So anyway, have fun. If you're interested, there's links in the show notes. I have the Wikipedia article for the leaded gas crime hypothesis. It's fascinating stuff, and it's somewhat compelling, although some experts say, yeah, not so much. Tech Talk. Analog versus digital multimeter. So, in short, an analog multimeter is one that has a gauge, like a view meter, like a needle that goes up and down that you can see moving. So, like if you put it on a 12-volt battery, it'll move up to 12 volts, provided you have the settings right. A digital multimeter has a LCD or LED, usually LCD these days, screen that says 12.7 volts. They do the same things and often in the same ways, but why would you ever have an analog one these days? Why have a needle when you can just have something that shows you the screen? Like you put your black cable on the negative terminal of a battery and you put your positive red cable on the positive terminal of the battery, and it says 12.7 volts. And, well, that's great. If you had one of the analog ones, you'd have to, like, look at the needle and see, and there's, like, different scales. So you'd have to figure out which scale to look at. And it's like, is that 12.7 or 1.27? Where did... Well, there is a reason to use analog multimeters, and I own some, and I actually own both, and I use them differently depending on what I'm doing. This was a conversation we had on Discord, which I thought was interesting, because somebody was gifted an old analog multimeter from their parents, and they were like, oh, that's a nice antique, but I'm just going to put it on the shelf, and others of us were like, whoa, no, there's use there. Here's an interesting case that's actually real world. You're trying to test a turn signal, and there's no lights, right? So you put on the turn signal and there's no light and you want to test it. So you want to test the circuit. So how do you do that? Well, if you had a digital multimeter, you would, you know, maybe you have alligator clips on your digital multimeter. You put the ground alligator clip on something that's grounded and you take the red positive alligator clip and put it on the wire that's supposed to be hot. And you turn on your turn signals and you see, well, nothing. Okay, well, so there's no power. So you trace it all the way back, and the fuse is good, and there's power at the fuse. You know, well, it could be that your digital multimeter just wasn't fast enough to detect that. It could be that your digital multimeter just wasn't fast enough to detect the voltage change that would make the light blink. If you use an analog multimeter, you will see the needle jump. And seeing the needle jump is actually more valuable in that particular case than just having a number. So it's almost a different use case, but there is a lag in digital multimeters that can be a problem in some cases. Most of the time, it's not going to matter. And you could argue that all you really need is an analog multimeter because it does everything that a digital multimeter does, most of them, and also has this needle bouncing feature. But the reality is that if you're trying to test the voltage or something, it's so much quicker to use a digital one. And you can see, oh, 12.2 volts, that's a little discharged. I wonder why. Side note, just because I'm talking about multimeters, I recommended a multimeter a few episodes ago because Hal recommended it to me. It was a very inexpensive multimeter that you had to recharge, but it was actually pretty good. It was like 15 bucks and little and had everything you need. It's still good. However, it does not work if it goes below freezing. I found this out in the VanFest trip that when the temperature got below freezing, it shut off to protect itself, which was not great because I needed it to work to protect me. So just so you know, if you have one of those multimeters, keep it somewhere warm, or if you need to use it, put it in your pants or something for a while. Product review. It's very unlikely that you will find a bargain in an airport store. But it happened to us, and it happened in Charlotte, North Carolina, where my wife and I were stuck for a while because of, air trouble, which is ongoing. And she said, I really would like to have a pillow for the next flight, and I didn't bring one. Maybe we can stop somewhere and get a pillow. And, pillows are big, and I said, maybe we can find an inflatable one. I don't know. So we were looking around for a store, and we actually went to an electronics store. They sell, headphones and stuff, and they had a little rack of things, and I saw an inflatable pillow there. And I said, what about this? And they were, 14 bucks, and there's an inflatable pillow. It's an inflatable pillow. I mean, how good could it be? Then I saw it was on sale, and I was like, that's pretty cool. And I saw it was really on sale. It was only $6. And so, let's buy two. So we bought two of them, and I still, I'm like, whatever. It's an inflatable pillow. How good can it be? Well, I will not ever travel without it. No, seriously. I've had inflatable pillows before. They're not comfortable. They're too squishy, and they're hot, and I just don't like them. And yeah, you can put them in a pillowcase or whatever. And I slept on an inflatable mattress for many, many months at one point in my life. I'm not a huge fan for long-term use. But these little pillows that they've come out with are actually pretty comfortable. And they inflate very quickly and they hold their air well. And they're shaped... Anyway, take a second look at these things. Because what I have learned is this little tiny pillow that is about the size of I hate to use this example, but a pack of cigarettes when it's folded up. You open it up and you can inflate it with one breath, and then you can actually sleep on it like a regular pillow in your van. If you're doing some minimalist thing, like maybe you're hiking or you just have literally no space in your van, you want to save every last inch, this will work well enough for you to sleep on it. But for me, what I like it for is on airplanes. I'm 6 foot tall. I'm a little bit weird in proportions, and airplane seats do not fit me. I know a lot of people have this problem. The headrest is between my shoulders, and even the extended headrests still, they don't actually get up to my head. And my arms don't reach. Everything's weird. That's what I'm trying to say. So I'm always having places that hurt because my body is contorted into this shape. Enter this pillow. I can just pull it out and inflate it and put it wherever I need to be a little bit more comfortable. Yeah, I can, if I'm, by a window, I can use it as a pillow to sleep there. But even if I'm just in a middle seat, which I dread, but it's happening more often lately, I can put the pillow on the armrest or beside the armrest. And it just helps make everything better. And I didn't know I needed this thing. It was a bargain at the airport. It made no sense to me. My wife has reason she needs a pillow with her almost all the time. It's perfect for her. I didn't think it would be perfect for me, but it is. So this isn't the exact same one I found, but it's very similar, and I have a link in the show notes. It's called very simply the Inflatable Camping Pillow, Travel Blow-Up Air Pillow, Neck Lumbar Support, Ultralight Camping Pillow for Outdoor Hike, Backpacking, Car, Beach, Airplane Sleeping Essentials, orange. Well, it turns out it comes in a great many colors. This one is $10. It's not as good a deal, but it looks almost identical to the ones I got. And it's great. And, you know, if you don't like the feel, it doesn't have that plastic feel. It's not really flocked, but it has a texture that's much more comfortable than that plasticky feel. It also doesn't have that springy, rubbery feel to it. And if I were going to sleep on this, like, let's say I'm in some weird minimalist situation where I'm going to sleep and I don't have a pillow and I'm using this, I would simply put a t-shirt or something over it. And that would be how I would sleep for the night. And I think it would be completely comfortable. So there's a link in the show notes. There's 8 million different ones of these. But the one I'm linking to is exactly the one, at least the shape and style that I'm using and I love. And $9.95 is absolutely worth it. It's actually on sale a little bit. And, oh, they've got blue and orange and turquoise and a bunch of different greens. Anyway, take a look. This might be something you need that you didn't know either. Tales from the road. So this sailboat thing, the Royal Clipper, 5-masted ship, 42 sails, full-rigged ship, sailing under sail. Like, we went from place to place under sail. Amazing experience. What does it have to do with van life? Because it's a big van with sails, all right? It's a wet van with sails. I don't actually mean that just to be a joke. You're living in a vehicle on this thing, and while it's at a completely different scale, there are some things that carry over. One of those things that carries over is a philosophy of travel. Why are these people on this vessel? It's not the fastest. It's not the fanciest. I mean, there's no bowling alleys or roller coasters or anything like that. It is maybe the most romantic. I mean, it's really cool being on deck and watching them hoist the sails, and then the engines turn off, and it's just quiet. You know, you hear this thing sailing. It's a very cool experience. But some of the people like that type of travel, but they were really there for the ports. And this was a sailing in the Grenadines, the Spice Islands. I mean, they have a bunch of different names, but it was Barbados and St. Lucia and St. Vincent and Grenada and Martinique. So, and little places there. The nice thing about the ship is it's small and you go to these little places. And we actually had a tender, which is a little boat on the ship that we got on, and that tender rammed the beach and a ramp came down like on D-Day. And that was how you got on the beach. That was fun. It wasn't quite as dramatic as D-Day, I promise you, but the method was the same. I met people all from all over the world on this trip, and you have communal dining. You go to dinner, and they sit you with somebody, which is nice, and you learn very, very quickly you are not going to impress anybody with your list of places you've been. I've been a lot of places. It impressed nobody, nor was I trying to. We were just sharing experiences, but everybody had been there. I mean, there was one guy I was having a conversation with. We had had a drink at the same bar in Bora Bora, and it wasn't even in the main part of Bora Bora, and we had walked on the same walkway on Moorea, which is an island off the coast of Tahiti. You know, these people had traveled, which was fun and great, but their philosophy of travel was they just wanted to be out traveling. They didn't really care where they'd went. Many of them had already been to these islands. That's what it was about for them. But this one couple we ate with, it was just my wife and I and this other couple for lunch. They were from Dallas. They were a little bit older than us, probably in their 70s. We did not ask ages. Asked where they were from. Very nice folks. Recognized their accent instantly, which is interesting because the Dallas, Texas accent isn't very strong. There's just a couple words here and there. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I've spent a lot of time down there volunteering with Team Rubicon, which is in Grapevine, which is part of DFW, blah, blah, blah. So I knew where they were from, and we just started talking, and we started mentioning what we were doing when we went to the ports. And my wife and I, for some reason, we decided to sign up for excursions in every port, which isn't what we normally do, but on this trip, we figured, what the heck? I don't know why we did that, honestly. But many of the tours were very good. And we talked about the things we were seeing. We went and saw a chocolate factory. That was pretty cool, actually. A lot of these rum distillery and tours and stuff, it's just like a factory. But this was actually hand-picked chocolate, dried in the sun, and then sorted and processed by hand with the help of machinery. But the chocolate was really good. I'm just saying, that was on Grenada. The chocolate factory in Grenada was really good. But these folks were like, well, yeah, the Caribbean, every place looks the same. There's really not much here. And they were really disappointed. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. Because we did not find that. I mean, of course, there's a similarity between Caribbean islands, but I can tell you the differences between St. Vincent and St. Lucia and Grenada and what's good in one place and good in another and which of those three places I would like to live, which would either be St. Lucia or St. Vincent. I can talk about why Martinique was a very different experience, partially because Martinique is technically in France. It's a totally different experience. But for these folks, it was all the same. And I was like, oh, interesting. So what tours did you go on? And I said, oh, no, we didn't do any tours. I'm like, well, okay. So what'd you do? Well, you know, every port we would just, you know, get off the ship and walk around the little area by the port. And, you know, we'd kind of get bored and go home. And I'm like, wow, that's not how to do this. And I didn't want to sound like Joe Traveler is going to educate the noobs on how to have a good time in their travel. I did not want to be that guy. And I wasn't, I promise. It was just like, oh, well, you know, sometimes the areas around the ports are actually the worst part of the experience because they're there to grab those tourist dollars and you have to go in a little bit. And the folks, I found out, were actually a little bit afraid of the tour excursions because they didn't want to be that far from the ship. They were concerned that maybe they wouldn't get back to the ship on time. And well, that makes sense. You know, if you're not back to the ship on time, it leaves without you. But they weren't willing to take any risks at all. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. So I thought about, all right, well, they liked the ship okay. How could this experience be better for them? And I mentioned that the ship is about to head to Europe, because after our trip, they did one more, and then they crossed the Atlantic and go to Europe and the Mediterranean and stuff. I thought, oh, maybe you'd like that better, because in Europe, when you get off the ship, there's a little bit of touristy stuff, but it's usually you're actually in the city. Most of these places they go are cultures built around the port. So the town is right there. I mean, if you get off the ship in Malta, you're in Malta. You know, you're in Valletta. You are there. You have to go up a big hill, but you're there. And the same is true for almost all these places. It's not like the Caribbean, where tourism is such a big revenue for them there's an area. In Mexico is definitely like this. In Jamaica, especially. But you get off the ship, and then this is like the tourist area with Diamonds International, and you have to get away from that crap. You don't have to do it in Europe. And so I thought maybe that would be more appealing to them. But their response was not what I expected. They said, oh, no, I don't think we'd want to go all that way. We wouldn't want to go over there. And again, it was a risk. They're from Texas. And if you look at the map of the United States, the Caribbean, a lot of the islands are on that same map. Europe's on a whole different map. And time zones. I mean, they were already a whole time zone away from their Texas time zone. Imagine being two time zones away, or six, or seven. These folks, in their retirement years, had taken a risk to take this sailing trip, but that was as far as they were willing to go. They were not willing to take the other risks you need to take to actually travel and see things. And that's fine. This is their vacation. They should do it any way they want. But it highlighted for me the difference between their philosophy of travel and my philosophy of travel. They might like a resort type of thing like sandals more than I would. In fact, I think they mentioned that they liked sandals. Sandals, to me, I think would feel restrictive and certainly more expensive than I would want to pay. But they don't want to go to Europe. You know, Europe with all its endless wonders. And I didn't even broach the concept of, say, Asia or Africa or Australia. I mean, that would just blow their minds. So we had a nice lunch and off they went. But I came back thinking that, you know, boy, there are many different ways to look at travel. And for them, they want a pleasant experience away from home. They don't want to explore too much. They just want to be somewhere warm in the winter or somewhere comfortable that's different from where they're from. Again, that's not a judgment. I'm just pointing out a difference. I don't think they would do very well in van life. I think the attitude they have, again, it sounds like I'm being negative towards them. I'm trying not to be, really. I would not be happy with their philosophy, but they are, and that's fine. But I don't think van life would work for them. And so that's kind of another indicator. If you are someone who would rather go to a resort and have people bring you drinks on the beach, if you'd rather do that, then go someplace you've never been before and figure out what you're going to do that day. That might be an indicator that van life's not for you, you know? And that's okay. you're probably not listening to this podcast. So it just, when you travel, you meet people. And what's interesting sometimes is meeting people from your own country in some place that's not your own country and seeing the different reactions to what's going on. And I hope to do more of that as we go here. And I will have more stories, I'm sure, from all the places I'm about to visit and all the cool vans I'm going to see and not be able to take home with me. A place to visit. I am going to try to go to some of this event. It's in the beginning of May, and it is Schoolypalooza, one of the great van life events that we have in the U.S. Schooly Swarm started as an event for schoolies, but it's actually open to everybody. Schooly to them is a mindset, and I agree. And so there are a lot of schoolies there, but there's a lot of folks in vans there too, and in cars, and it doesn't matter. They're doing a tribute to Route 66, which is 100 years old this year. And they're going to be in Pontiac, Illinois to start this off. Now, Pontiac is one of the many centers for Route 66. There's a bunch of places on Route 66 that have museums and like, this is the official start of Route 66. It's not. The official start of Route 66 is the Art Institute in downtown Chicago. That is true. But Route 66 actually has moved around over the years, and there's a lot of roads in Illinois that used to be part of Route 66 and then were abandoned. In fact, there's one stretch that's made of brick. It's a whole highway made of brick, and it's still there. You can still go check it out, but it's not part of any major highway anymore. Route 66 has tons and tons of stuff to see, but Pontiac has really embraced it, and there's all kinds of murals and a museum. And one of the coolest things on Route 66, in my opinion, there is a double-decker schoolie that is parked at the museum in Pontiac that you can tour, and this thing was built, I think, in the 70s, and this guy just went wild with an old school bus and created basically a mansion on wheels. But don't think a fancy mansion. Think just this massive vehicle that has everything you could ever want, hand-built by found objects. It is a really, really cool thing to see, and it's going to be right there in Pontiac. If you go, you'll definitely be able to see it. So after this event in Pontiac, they're going to do a 10-day private full swarm gathering. And there's a whole bunch of other plans there. A lot of folks are going to head on down Route 66 as far as they can go. So this is either a one-day event, a weekend event, or a whole huge event, as much as you would like to do. But it's May 2nd and 3rd in Pontiac, Illinois, this year. And I'm going to try to get down to Pontiac for the beginning. I do not have time to do much more than that, unfortunately. But I will try to be in Pontiac on the 2nd and 3rd. And all the information you need is at schoolieswarm.com/route-66. And I'll have a link in the show notes, of course, but just search Schoolie Swarm Route 66 and you'll find it. There's no question. I know these folks. They're very, very good folks. They are incredibly welcoming. I mean, literally, these are the kind of folks that you just show up and they're telling you to sit down and have a meal because they've cooked food for 30 people. These are the good folks. If you are new to van life, interested in van life, wondering what it's like to move from a van to a schoolie, just looking for a community of super nice folks that are just exploring their lives as they explore the road, this is a place to go. And Pontiac's cool in itself. So Schoolie Swarm, Route 66, those are the terms you're looking for. And thank you to Bruce for reminding me to talk about that. Resource recommendation. Okay, this is odd, but I'm going to mention it because there's a time limit here. I've talked a lot about Antarctica, and I want to mention to you that I'm going back, but I'm going back differently. I'm going back in a much more affordable way, and you're invited. Now, I'm cautious about this because I'm basically putting together a group of people to go to Antarctica in January of 2028, but this is not the same trip, so I want to be very clear about what we're talking about. If you do an expedition to Antarctica, you usually leave from Ushuaia, which is at the very southern point in Argentina, head straight to the peninsula, stop in a bunch of places in the peninsula, come back, maybe see a couple islands on the way back, and end in Ushuaia. That is not what this trip is. Those trips cost about $15,000. This isn't that. This is a trip on a normal quote-unquote cruise ship, the Celebrity Equinox, which is a ship I've been on before. It's a nice ship. I like it. And we're going to leave from Buenos Aires, Argentina, which if you look at a map, is hell and gone from Ushuaia. It's way up north. The reason we're doing that is it's easier to fly to Buenos Aires than to Ushuaia. That's going to save tons of money right there. And Buenos Aires is a huge European-style city in South America with 30 million people. Yeah, they've got weird politics problems. Who doesn't? But flying in and coming back there, it's a round trip, is much easier. From there, it sails to Ushuaia, so you see everything in Ushuaia, and then it goes to Antarctica. But, and here's the key thing, you do not get off the ship in Antarctica. If the only thing you care about is walking in Antarctica, this isn't going to be that trip for you. But if you want to go to Antarctica and see it, and see the mountains and glaciers, and be surrounded by whales and orcas and penguins in the water and all that stuff, this is the trip. You will be able to do that in the most comfort and for the least expense possible. After we go all the way down to Antarctica, we'll spend a day at Elephant Island, again, not getting off, but sailing around. And then we go to the Falkland Islands, which is a difficult place to get to, but we're going to try. And then we go to another part of Argentina where there are penguins. You will walk with penguins on this trip if you want to. Absolutely. You'll be swarmed by penguins as much as you can stand. Penguins everywhere, if you want to. Then we go to Montevideo in Uruguay, which is a great place. I love Uruguay. If I were going to move anywhere in South America, it would be Uruguay. And then back over to Argentina. This takes 2 weeks to do all this. There's endless opportunity to extend the trip. In Ushuaia, you can do a penguin tour. You can go into the Tierra del Fuego National Park. You can go to the most southern post office in the world, sort of, because all the bases in Antarctica have them, you know. You need to do research if you want to do this. The reason I'm mentioning this to you is that I love Antarctica, and I want people to go there if they can. And this way of doing it is the most affordable and most comfortable for most people. Because you can do this for less than $5,000 a person. And that is far and away the cheapest way to do this. So, if you're interested, there's a link in the show notes that explains everything. And I'm not selling this. I'm being very, very honest. This is an opportunity. It's not for everybody. But there's a link in the show notes that you can read more about this specific trip. And you can also just contact me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And I would be happy to have a one-on-one conversation with you. I don't know how many people are going. I've got about 20 people signed up so far. I don't know if we're going to have 20 or 40. We'll see. But we're talking about $5,000 a person for a balcony cabin, and you will probably just spend a day on your balcony looking out at icebergs and whales and mountains and glaciers, and the day is 20 hours long. It's like a long time to do it. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 292 of Built to Go. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Thank you for putting up with all my weirdness, because that's all I got, folks. Until next time, remember the words of Fernando Pessoa, a philosopher from Lisbon, Portugal, who said, "I abhor new ways of life and unfamiliar places. The idea of traveling nauseates me."